Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Welcome to our study of 1 Kings. Today we're going to be in chapters 9 and 10, which basically deals with the covenant between Solomon and God and some of the building and fame of Solomon, and then a summary statement about his kingship. So let's begin. The parallel passage is very significant. It's in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 11, through 2 Chronicles 9:28. You should always compare Chronicles when you're in Kings. Now, it came about when Solomon, of course his name means peace, shalom, had finished the building of the house of the Lord. Now, we learned that the house of the Lord was basically started in Solomon's fourth year, and it took 7 years for the temple to be built. Then his palace took 13 more years. We get this by comparing chapter 6, verse 38, with 7:1. So we're about 20 years into Solomon's reign, something like that. The king's house and all that Solomon desired to do. Now, this desire to do is a very strong term in Hebrew. It seems to imply that Solomon's heart was really into building programs, a priority of his kingship. And the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time. Now, God appeared first to Solomon at Gibeon back in chapter 3, verse 5. The fact that God appeared to Solomon twice shows something of the seriousness of Solomon's sin in chapter 11. After these two gracious visitations of God, Solomon's sin is all the more vicious and horrendous. Notice in verse 3, "And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer." Now, there's a much fuller account in 2 Chronicles 7, 12 through 20. This is that very famous passage, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray." That's the context of this very setting in 2 Chronicles, so I hope you'll look at that. "I have consecrated this house." This is the Hebrew word kadosh. It means to set apart, to make holy. And here it's separated to God for the specific purpose of God and man meeting. That's man's sins being dealt with, God being praised. Notice it says, "by putting my name here forever." Now, the word forever is the word olam. In Hebrew, that must be interpreted in light of the context. Sometimes it means forever and ever. Other times it means for that appropriate time. Because Jerusalem is going to be destroyed by the Babylonians later, it's obvious olam meaning forever as long as you keep the covenant. And those conditions are seen again in verse 4 and verse 6. God would protect this city forever if Solomon would walk in his ways. Now, this conditional covenant is going to be seen throughout here, particularly in verse 4 and 5, which is, of course, a reflection of 2 Samuel chapter 7, where God made this very same promise to David. Notice where it mentions here, "putting my name there." If you remember Deuteronomy, there was a place that God was going to cause his name to dwell, the place where the Ark of the Covenant would reside, which is a symbol of God's presence, once they crossed the Jordan River. First it was Gilgal, then it was Shiloh, later Bethel, but finally it would be Jerusalem. Notice it says, "and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually." Now, in chapter 8, verse 29, God only mentions his eyes. But here it's the idea of my heart, his person, his interest, his care would be symbolized in this temple. "As far as you, if you will walk before me." And here's the conditional element. Now, it mentions, "as David your father walked." Of course, this is very important to us to realize that David was a man after God's own heart. A man who, though he sinned and though he had terrible problems in his life, really was a man that tried to follow God. So sin is not the problem here. It's having a wholehearted devotion to God. And what will happen with Solomon, as we learn in chapter 11, his wives will pull his heart away from the Lord to follow after their God. So though David was a sinner, he still desired to know God, desired to follow God. I think that's really important to realize that it's not sinlessness we're looking for, but a whole heart. A real desire to follow God. Notice at verse 5, "And I will establish the throne of your kingdom forever over Israel, just as I promised your father." And again, that's a direct reference and a direct allusion to 2 Samuel chapter 7. "But if you or your son shall indeed turn away." Now, this "turn away" is a Hebrew idiom for an incomplete allegiance to God, going after foreign God, making foreign alliances, trusting in their own strength. And so here is that conditional covenant seen over and over again. Look at verse 7. "Then I will cut off," that's a very strong term, cut off, "Israel from the land which I had given them." You might want to see Deuteronomy 28:37, where this very same thing was mentioned. People say God's unfair. He took the Canaanites out of the land, and he just gave the land to the Jews. I want you to know that Genesis chapter 15:6 shows us that, not 15:6, 15:16, that it was because of the Amorite sin. And when the Jews do the very same thing that the Amorites did, God will take them out of the land also. God is no respecter of persons. So basically here in verse 7, we're talking about the exile. Look at this. The house which I have consecrated with my name, I will cast out of my sight. The destruction of the temple is mentioned here. This word cast out is a Hebrew idiom for divorce. A woman is cast out of the house. That's why marriage is probably the best biblical analogy for understanding the covenant. There are reciprocal promises and agreements. And so here it's the divorce word used. In verse 8, we have the idea this house will become a heap of ruins. Another allusion to the destruction of the temple. There are several different translations here. Some say shall be high, but the implication of the rest of the verse is a high heap of ruins that people will see and say, oh my, what's happened here? Notice in verse 8 where it says, those who pass by will be astonished and hiss. You might well see the parallel passages for this in 2 Chronicles 29:8, Jeremiah 18:16, Jeremiah 19:8, Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 9 and 18, along with Micah chapter 6, verse 16. I know it's hard to write all those down. I hope you send for our free outline that accompanies these tapes where they're all already written for you. Notice it says, and why has the Lord done this to the land? This is a very important question. It's to show that God's purpose in calling the Jews, in building the temple, and blessing Solomon throughout the history of the Jews, God's purpose was to communicate to Gentiles. God chose Abraham to choose a world. He always wanted to show his blessing through the Jews, but even when he had to judge the Jews, he was still in the process of speaking to the Gentiles. You might want to see Deuteronomy 29, verse 22 through 28, and Jeremiah 22, verses 8 and following. Notice in verse 9, and they will say, because the Lord, they forsook the Lord. And there's that exact reference to the fact that God was trying to speak to the world through the Jews. Notice now in verse 10 where it says, and it came about at the end of 20 years. Well, it started in the fourth year of Solomon's when he started the building, and he lasted 7 years for the temple, 13 years for his palace, so we're 24 years into Solomon's reign. Notice in verse 11, then Hiram, king of Tyre, supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress timber and gold according to all he desired. Now, we learn from verse 14 that this was not only materials, but 120 talents of silver. Oh, that's tons of silver. It seems that maybe Solomon tried to pay him back by giving him 20 cities of Galilee. That's mentioned here in verse 11. But from other passages of scriptures, this was a mixed population era. Some say the reason that the king didn't like this, and the word Kabul, some say it means pledge. That's what Kyle says, though Josephus says it means displeasure, and that seems to fit the context best. Some say that Solomon just gave it to him as a pledge because Solomon buys them back in 2 Chronicles 8:2. And that seems the best interpretation because Solomon couldn't give away the promised land, so it was kind of like a pledge for the money. Others say, no, he tried to give them these cities, but Hiram didn't want them because Hiram wanted a coastal city or maybe some fields where he could grow crops. We know that Phoenicia was dependent on Galilee. But these cities mentioned were all in the hill country and mixed population, and Hiram expresses his displeasure with these cities. In verse 14, my New American Standard said, and Solomon sent. But the verb tense here in Hebrew is had sent, which shows something in the past. So the pledge interpretation, I think, is best when combined with 2 Chronicles 8:2. Now in verse 15, and this is the account of forced labor. Now we learn from other passages that all the Canaanites left in the land, Solomon turned into forced labor for his building projects. But it also seems to mention that he turned the children of Israel, not into forced labor, because that would make them slaves. But it seems from other sources that he turned them into levies, and every tribe had to supply so many young men for a period of 3 months or 90 days, and then they could go back to their land, and that seems to refer to this. Notice it says, he built his own house and the Milo. Now, the Septuagint has citadel or castle. But really, the Hebrew word Milo means field, and many of us think it was some kind of field dirt, possibly between Mount Moriah and Mount Zion, or some of the other mountains inside the city of Jerusalem, or that he built up the walls some way with field dirt or terraces, and that's what this seems to imply. Now, notice, if you would, there's three cities mentioned here, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Hazor is a northern city. Megiddo is in the plain of Jezreel. We know it in the New Testament as Armageddon. And then Gezer is down on the Philistine border. One in the north, one in the central, one in the south, kind of as places to put his army in case he needed them for rapid deployment. All of these are on major trade routes, which shows he also controlled these trade routes for taxation purposes. For the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Giza and burned it with fire and killed the Canaanites who lived in the city. This shows us that although Joshua destroyed this city and the king in Joshua 10:33, we learn from Judges 1:29 that the tribal allocation of Judah had not been able to take this area over, and the Canaanites still lived in the land until Egypt captured it and made it a dowry for his daughter, a dowry in marriage with Solomon. Notice then in verse 17, and Solomon rebuilt Gezer, and then mentioned these other cities. Now, notice in verse 18, the term Tamar. Because of the parallel in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 4, this should probably be Tadmor, T-A-D-M-O-R. It's interesting to me that as we found archaeologically these different cities of Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, that all of the structure is pretty much similar. It's kind of compared with the Phoenician architecture, but the gate structure is so similar it shows that the architecture and the construction was done at the same time, which pretty much adds evidence to the historicity of this account. Notice it says in verse 19, and all the storage city, places for the supplies for troops. It never says that Megiddo is a chariot city. We know from archaeology there were many ruins of chariots found there, but modern archaeologists think that was Ahab's chariot some 70 years later and not Solomon's. Notice it says in verse 21, their descendants who were left after them in the land whom the sons of Israel were unable to utterly destroy. The word utterly destroy is the word harem. It's part of the holy war concept where all of the Canaanites were supposed to die in Solomon's rebellion. But they didn't kill all of them, and they were, of course, a thorn in their side the rest of their days. Notice it says, but Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel. And, of course, I think this is where that three-month levy and not permanent slaves like the Canaanites. Notice verse 23. And these were the chief officers who were over Solomon's work, 550. The fact that he had that many foremen shows you the level of Solomon's work throughout the Promised Land during his days. As soon as Pharaoh's daughter came up from the city of David to her house, we learn from the parallel in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 11, that as soon as Solomon dedicated the temple, he brought Pharaoh's daughter into her own house, which is, of course, to the north. The reason for that is, since the area was consecrated, he felt like it was holy, and she needed to be moved out of that area where she was staying. In verse 25, it says, and three times a year Solomon offered burnt offerings. From 2 Chronicles 8:13, we understand this is the Feast of Passover, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Booths. Some commentators assume that this is mentioned because of the negative note found in chapter 3, verse 3, where Solomon offered incense on the high places, and this shows he only did it at the designated shrine in Jerusalem and only during the three major feast days. Also notice here, in verse 26, it talks about Solomon built a fleet of ships. And we learn about this from chapter 10, verse 22, that it was basically along the plans of the Phoenicians, and it even had Phoenician sailors. Now, of course, this would mean that Solomon basically did it in the Red Sea, in the Gulf of Aqaba, modern Eilat, and archaeology has found that port. So it was a trade with the people, probably in India and Africa, that kind of trade. Notice it mentions here, let's see, toward the land, the Red Sea in the land of Edom. That shows it's not the Red Sea over where they crossed in the Exodus, but the other little arm of the Red Sea on the other side of Sinai, close to the land of Edom. Hiram sent servants to the fleet. They were Phoenician sailors. And notice they went to Ophir. Now, Ophir has been identified with several different geographical locations. Some say Arabia, some say Africa, and some say India. Because all of the things mentioned in chapter 10, verse 22, are indigenous to India, most would believe that India is a best place, not for certain, but probably a source of these trading items. Now, in chapter 10, it mentions about the account of the Queen of Sheba. This is quoted by Jesus in Matthew 12:49. He uses her as somebody who recognized the greatness of Solomon. And I think it's a very interesting parallel. I hope you look at this. Even the Quran mentions this, has an account in Surah 54 about this. It's kind of humorous, so I'll tell you quickly. Solomon had heard that Queen of Sheba was pretty, but he'd also heard the terrible rumor that she had hairy legs. And who wants to date a woman with hairy legs? So he tried to find some scheme to find out if she really did. So, this is in the Quran, Surah 54. He built a sea of crystal, and underneath were fish. And so when the Queen of Sheba approached, she would hopefully raise her skirts, to keep from getting them wet, and Solomon could see if she had hairy legs. Lo and behold, she had hairy legs. But Solomon wasn't through. His wise men made the first debilatory to help her. There's still even an ancient tradition that comes from Ethiopia that she came to be impregnated by Solomon, and the Ethiopians to this day say their royal leaders are a child of Solomon. But I think that's pretty much apocryphal, because I don't think the Queen of Sheba is from Ethiopia. It seems that the modern best scholarly identification is in southern Arabia, in the modern area of Yemen, and not in Ethiopia. Well, the Queen of Sheba came. And notice she had heard about the fame of Solomon, but that Solomon's fame is connected with the name of the Lord. That was the purpose of his fame, was to draw attention to God, not draw attention to Solomon. We've got to be careful of these spiritual gifts and the blessings of God. They're never meant to draw attention to us, but always to reflect glory to God and not with men. Now, there have been several reasons why people think she came. It's obvious she wanted to come make some agreements with Solomon about these trade routes. It's obvious she had curiosity about his wisdom. But folks, I think it's also maybe possible, and I think the context shows that she had a thirst for God, and maybe she thought Solomon could help her. It never says that she trusted the Lord, but she says some wonderful things about Solomon and his God. So this entire retinue comes, and carrying many spices and gold, and the recorder of this says more than they've ever seen at any other time. And look at verse 4. And the queen of Solomon perceived all the wisdom of Solomon and the house that he had built. And then verse 5 talks about the house. It seems there are several things here. From verse 1, it's obvious that she gave him riddles to answer, and he answered the riddles. From verse 4 and 5, that she could see his wisdom in his design of his palace and the way his servants were structured and ministered in the palace. So there were several different areas that Solomon's wisdom included, not just intellectual, but practical and organizational also. Notice in verse 5, after she heard all that he did, it says that there was no spirit left in her, and she was awed by Solomon's wisdom. And she mentions, the report I heard was not even half of the truth. You're much wiser than I thought. Look at verse 9. Bless the Lord your God who delights in you. Again, the purpose of Solomon's wisdom, the purpose of God's blessing for the Jews, is seen so clearly in Deuteronomy 27 and 28, was not just the Jews have more than anybody else, or the Jews enjoy the presence of God in a restricted sense, but that the Gentiles be attracted by the wisdom and blessing of God, and they also come to the one true God. And I think that's what we see here again. Now, here in verse 10, it talks about she left. I think she probably established trade routes. I think the idea that she was impregnated by Solomon is absolutely a legend, and there's nothing here in the account at all. Now, in verse 11, it mentions these special trees called almug. We have no idea what those are. It's been lost. There are many theories, but none of us know. Notice in verse 13 that Solomon gave the Queen of Sheba some things. Obviously, a reciprocal covenant agreement, trade agreement, and it went both ways. Look at verse 14. Now the weight of gold which came into Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Friends, that's about 25 tons of gold. This fact that it came in every year shows that it was either taxation on the trade routes or somehow a tribute that came yearly. Now let's see. I'm not going to go through all this gold stuff. He made some shields, but they weren't for battle. They were these large shields. They were decoration shields. Later on, Shishak, Pharaoh, will take them in captivity. Notice in verse 19 where it talks about his throne, a great throne made of ivory overlaid with gold, six steps with a lion on each one. And in verse 19 it says, there were six steps to the throne and a round top to the throne. Now the Septuagint has, for the round top, it has the heads of calves. This is followed by the New English Bible and the Revised Standard Version. These calves were a symbol many times of the fertility god. We see them under the laver in the temple, and calves, I think, is a better interpretation probably than round top. Notice that in verse 21 where it says, it was considered valuable in the days of Solomon. It was not considered valuable. This is obviously a later editor, someone who wrote this or added to it later on after Solomon's day. And you'll see this throughout the Bible, that usually the things are recorded in the day, but someone later edits and adds to it and combines it. These little phrases, little editorial notes are found throughout. For the king had a sea of ships of Tarshish. Now the word Tarshish is literally a ship that means a ore ship, a large ocean-going ore ship. Now Tarshish is also thought to be a geographical location, somewhere in Spain, somewhere in Sardinia, but I think here it's a type of ship. And not exactly the ships that were in the Mediterranean. Notice the word peacocks here. King James has peacocks in verse 22, but the Jerusalem Bible has the word baboons, and the New English Bible has the word monkeys. I think monkeys or baboons is a better translation of this Hebrew word than peacocks. Then verse 23 and following of chapter 10 is a summary of all that Solomon did. So King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth. Now you might want to see Matthew 6:29, where it says, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed as one of these flowers of the desert. Oh my. Solomon was so rich, but God clothed the flowers even better than he. Notice it says, in riches and in wisdom. Riches is mentioned first. Now Solomon did everything Deuteronomy 17 said don't do, Solomon did. He multiplied wives, he multiplied horses, he multiplied riches. And Solomon, though he starts so well in chapter 11, we'll see, comes to a terrible end. So he had riches and wisdom. You may want to see Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 17 again. And all the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon. Why? I think it's God's way for the world to come to know him. It's not that Solomon is to be so hot. God is always trying to bring the world to him. God's heart beats for his creation made in his image. He longed to know man. He picked Abraham to pick a nation to be a kingdom of priests, Exodus 19, 4 and 5. Because all the world belonged to him. So the world was trying to come to Solomon. Why? To know God. To know truth. Oh, men are seeking for God today. We don't have a Solomon with us. Jesus said, Matthew 12, 49, someone greater than Solomon is with you. Today we seek God and seek knowledge in Jesus Christ, who is the image of the invisible God. Here they came to Solomon because through him they could know what could be known of God. I think it's this universal thing that I see throughout the Old Testament. Now, and they brought every man his gift. Now, this may be a tribute or it may be a gift. We're not sure. But again, notice it says so much year by year. And so it seems to be a taxation setting. And now Solomon gathered chariots. Now, these were forbidden in Deuteronomy 17, 16. David destroyed the chariots and hamstrung the horses, but Solomon seems to have gathered chariots. Now, he seems to be involved in international trade, military trade. Maybe he would buy the chariots from Egypt, buy the horses for somewhere else, and sell them to others once he had all that he wanted. Chariots are only good in the lowlands. Originally, the Philistines were invincible because they had iron weapons and chariots. Because most of the Hebrews live in the hill countries where chariots were not effective. But Megiddo is a plain, Hazor is a plain, Gezer is a plain, and so Solomon put chariots probably in all of these cities. Now the problem here about gathering chariots is not just that you tend to rely on your military might. Remember how David sinned in numbering Israel, relying in his own strength? But the fact he had to go to foreign powers to buy the horses and buy the chariots showed something of a foreign alliance here, and foreign alliances are always condemned in the Bible because they involve the worship of that country's gods in this day also. Now, notice where it mentions here in verse 28 the word Egypt and Q, K-U-E. Most modern scholarship identifies Q with the area of Cyrenia. That's in modern Turkey, and that's probably what Q is. And the chariot was imported from Egypt, 600 shekels, that's a weight of silver, and they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites. Now, the Hittites are the major power in what we would call modern Turkey. For years, nobody even heard about the Hittites. The Bible was the only place to mention them, and yet further archaeology, since about 1950, has found a library of over 2,000 cuneiform tablets that again confirmed the historicity of the Bible. And I think we see every time archaeology has done that, the Bible has been confirmed as historically accurate. So the Hittites would buy the chariot, and Solomon was kind of a middleman. You know, it says of Solomon that he wrote Song of Songs when he was young, Proverbs when he was middle-aged, and Ecclesiastes when he was old. And I think you see something of the man Solomon here. Had a desire to build. Now, he didn't expand the country militarily, but he organized it and protected. And he really wanted to build these things. I think that was wonderful. I think the whole world was coming to him for knowledge. But God help us, Solomon got away from the Lord. But folks, there was one greater than Solomon that was coming, who will not get away from the Lord, and who has opened the door for all of us. And so I think, though we see in great sorrow what happened to this one son of David, there is another son of David coming. As Solomon was meant to bring the whole world to God and failed, we're going to see in Christ that the fulfillment of God wanting the world to know him will be found in this other son of David. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.